Acts, and they believe that that holiness and happiness go together. Know God by being happy. And so what they do is they will gather together and they'll just be driving along, and at a stop sign they'll just stop and they'll all jump out of the car and they'll start running around like a Chinese fire drill or something, and around the car, or they'll stop in the market and they'll just start a party. They'll just be dancing and singing and stuff. They think that happiness, you might as well be happy, that happiness and holiness can actually go together. Right? I think it's a great idea, and it actually connects with a lot of things like Jonathan Edwards might say, but there's a lot of communities of Christians that would say, oh no, it's gloominess and holiness are the things that go together. But no, there's great opportunity for happiness and holiness to go together. I think it's very interesting. Some of us might be like, where do we sign up? Are there any Hillsborough Non-Ox? I could use some celebration. But there are times in our lives when pursuing happiness and holiness together don't seem right. Right? There's times in our lives where we are overwhelmed with feelings of sorrow and grief. Where there's times when we're mourning a loss of one thing or another. And so, as much as I think perhaps there's things to learn from the non-ox, it's not what we need all the time. Some of the times we do need to figure out, what do we do with our grief and our mourning and our sadness? And when you read the Psalms, Israel's song book, expression of faith, you oftentimes see psalms of lament. Right? Lament is this mourning and sorrow and expressing your grief. And so I want us to look this morning at a psalm of lament, perhaps the psalm of lament, Psalm 22. My goals are twofold. One, I want to help the Scriptures kind of shape us in how we deal with our grief, with how do we give faithful expression to our mourning and sadness. But also, since we're moving towards Good Friday, I want us to try to have some tools to enter into and understand and experience Christ's lament on our behalf, so that we might faithfully honor him and remember and draw near to him. So I want this morning we'll look at Psalm 22. I want to look at 3 points. How do we find comfort in the midst of grief, sorrow, and lament? Then why did he not receive comfort? And then his lament fills our gap of lament. Let me read this for us. Psalm 22. To the choir master, according to the Doe of the Dawn, a psalm of David. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted, they trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me mock me, and they make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for delights in him. Yet you are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breast. On you was I cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God. Let's stop there for a moment. So the situation is, so how do we find comfort in the midst of our grief, sorrow, and lament? Obviously, the psalmist is going through a situation of deep sorrow and grief about something or other, right? Something is causing him to cry out to God in lament. And so he's experiencing some acute aspect of lament. He's not just some slight difficulty he's experiencing. But a lament, I think the best way to define it is it's a gap between what we feel should happen and what is actually happening. Right? So lament is most acute when you realize, when you feel like this shouldn't be taking place. The way the world is made, the way internally I experience this, this shouldn't be happening, but it is happening. And so there's this gap between those two. So lament is not just a hard swim practice or a hard soccer practice, because you signed up for that. You know that that's going to take place, right? You can be like, oh, the life is so hard and these athletic trainings, but you signed up for it. There's not a gap there, right? Or your corporate job, you're offered this promotion and you're like, yeah, it's going to be great. But and then once you get into it and it's really, really hard, you're like, well, I knew it was going to be hard. There's a reason why they're going to pay me more money, right? I can't really lament that because I knew it was going to be hard. But there are things in life where we experience this deep sorrow and regret this mourning, and we're grieving because it's not supposed to be that way, right? There's a great loss that took place somewhere. Something was lost. An opportunity was lost that should have been found. Right, relationships are lost due to conflict. Relationships are not supposed to break down and have alienation because of conflict. Sometimes families experience miscarriages, and there's a great lament there because babies are supposed to live. Pregnancies are supposed to come forth, and we have all these hopes and dreams about this child, and then they're dashed in a miscarriage. Loved ones who either slowly or suddenly are taken from us by disease or death. We experience grief there because it's not supposed to happen that way. Recently it was the anniversary of the Sandy Hook massacre. Right? Murder is not supposed to happen. We feel it in the fiber of all of our beings. People aren't supposed to kill other people. There's not supposed to be, on top of that, mass killing. But even on top of that, young children are not supposed to be murdered like that, right? Even in, there was an interview on NPR of someone who interviewed Adam Lansing's father, and he says, even in Herodotus, the history, says the most grievous, horrible thing you can do is to murder children. And so that's part of the why there's a national lament over what took place there. So the psalmist here is experiencing lament, right? Something is not supposed to be this bad, but it is. And then it's his sorrow is accentuated because God doesn't seem to be answering him, right? God is present, but it doesn't seem to be. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? I cry to you by day, you do not answer. By night, I find no rest. Day and night means the totality of always. Lord, I'm not hearing your voice. I'm not experiencing your comfort. Where are you in the midst of this? He feels as if God is not present. And he's asking why in verse 1. Why have you forsaken me? But he doesn't really just want an intellectual answer. He wants God to come and act and do something to bring his comfort, to resolve the situation, to save him in one way or another. He wants that gap between what we feel like should be the case and what he is experiencing is the case to be filled, to be closed up. But what's more, he's feeling even more. Because look at 6, 7, and 8. He says, I'm a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me mock me, and they make mouths at me, they wag their heads. He's not only experiencing internal problems with the situation, but people outside of him are maligning him, right? They're accusing him. They're sarcastically blaspheming him. They say, he trusts in the Lord, let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for delights in him. They're maligning his view of who God is, actually. So, lament. Are you in a season of lament? I know some of you are, but a lot of you probably are not. Right? We don't all go through the same cycle of those things, but we do experience lament at different times. Right? Some of you are now, but others of us, think back to the last year. When were there times when you were in lament, when you were mourning some loss, when there was a gap between what should be and what you were experiencing? If I think back to 2013, one of my laments was Annabelle's concussion. Right? It's one of those things that's not supposed to happen when you sign your child up for swimming, right? It's understandable a little bit more in like soccer or something like that. But when the effects just keep going on and on and on, it's like, this is not supposed to happen. Lord, how do I navigate this situation? How do we day by day continue to step through the academics and the swim and her desires and her mood and our hopes for her, right? There's times of lament there. There's also lament in 2013 in the church, right? It's not supposed to be the case that there's conflict in the church and there's sadness and there's leaving and grieving. It's not supposed to be that way. It's part of our lament. How do we usually deal with our lament in our society? Oftentimes, we sue people for our lament. Right? We go through, we're a litigious society, we go through something bad and we say, well, at least I can get a little bit of comfort by getting money out of the situation. And yet it's really ridiculous in some ways because money is nowhere near significant to fill that gap. But it's interesting, even when someone says, well, Rosh, you ought to sue over the concussion. It's like, much more complicated than that. We rationalize our grief and lament. We intellectualize it and say, well, I understand this, and we try to grab hold of that gap and push it together with just mental exertion, but it's too strong. It's like magnets that won't go together. We can't merely just rationalize it. We can't ignore it. It won't go away. We sometimes are consumed by it, right? We're almost sucked into that gap, and we don't know what to do over that lament. Sometimes we just resign ourselves to, this is what I deserve, or this is what is either my life, or this is what the Christian life involves, and we give up hope here. So where are you with lament? Are you in lament now? Can you look back to a time in the last year or two when you were in lament? But one of the things this psalm does is it gives us some instructions for how we do find comfort. The first one is that the psalmist very honestly dialogues with God. Right? The psalmist says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Right? And then repeats the whole thing again. Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? We've talked before in Hebrew, you say something twice, it's bold, it's underlined, it's screaming it out. So he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? The first thing he tells us to help find comfort is it is appropriate. It's fine, it's good. God wants our honesty, right? He doesn't want us just to assume the most godly thing to do is to close down and to bear up under it and to say, well, God's right and I must be doing something wrong here. No, God invites and longs for our honest engagement of Him. The first quote on top of the bulletin helps us think about that. Although the Old Testament constantly stresses the importance of trust as characterizing the true human response to God, the general canonical presentation is such that these are not to be conceived in any simplistic way, as though life were simply a matter of obeying orders. Rather, there's a recurrent portrayal of life under God as containing space for dialogue with God, with room for questions and answers. Obedience to God is to be set in the context of an intelligent relationship and not mindless. God gives us space, even in the call to respect and honor and believe in Him, space for dialogue, for honesty, for our honest questions, for our burning true realities to be exposed to Him. And so the psalmist doesn't ignore a situation. He doesn't assume he deserves it. He doesn't just say it's neutral. Right? He expresses his emotions. He prays his emotions. He prays that gap between what he believes should be, what God's word says should be, and what he's experiencing. He's saying, God, you got to come in and enter this gap. I'm languishing here. I'm failing. I'm grieving here. Come and answer me. And so it does require some element of trust, right? By him coming and saying, my God, he's finding enough trust and faith in God at least to come and unload his questions and his heart and his grief before God. And so with whatever faith we find, whatever trust we can manage, we take that and we bring the honesty of all that we're experiencing before to God. And then he does something that's very interesting. The reason I put some asterisks on 1 and 2 and 6, 7, 8 is to set them apart. He starts with, look at 1 and 2, with complaint. Why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from me? But then he switches in 3, 4, 5. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted, and they trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. He expresses that trust and that he has a confidence. He expresses as much confidence as he has. And here it's about how God has acted in the past. He remembers how God has saved his forefathers in the past. But it's not just a simple thing. Then he goes back to 6, 7, 8 to complaint, but I'm a worm and not a man. I'm scorned by mankind, despised by the people. Everyone else they're mocking me. They're sarcastically blaspheming me. But then he comes back again with confidence in 9 and 10. Yet you are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breast. On you I was cast from my birth. From my mother's womb you have been my God. So there's this back and forth between complaint and grief and honesty and then faith and trust. And so part of that faith and trust is how God has acted in the past, but part of it's also very, very personal. You're the one who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breast. You are the one that called me to faith and enabled me to have faith. On you I was cast from my birth. And so there's this back and forth of complaint and confidence. And so it shows us that's what's natural. That's what's godly. That's what's holy in the midst of grief. It's not trying to manufacture one thing or another, but it's living in both and letting both have expression. So if you're in lament, you even can just pick up the author's words here and say, my God, why have you allowed this to happen? Why am I feeling so bad? Why have you allowed these situations, this gap, to appear in my life? And then as much as you have faith and trust to alternate, here's what I'm going through. You've got to help me. But I do believe, I trust you. You've acted in the past. I remember. If you're not right now in lament, then it's probably a good practice to remember and to go over his promises so that when you are in lament, you can pick those up again, right? To think back through what are the ways that God has shown you his graciousness and his graciousness and more than you deserve, right? So to practice now the remembering of his promises and his faithfulness to you and his unfailing love helps us to have the resources when we're in sorrow to have that faith and trust, to cling to him even in the midst of as we share our sorrow. And so there's lots of prayers of lament. They show us, be honest with God with how you're feeling. But one way or another, find enough faith and trust to hang on to Him and call out to Him, cry out to Him, to come and fill and to close the gap that you are experiencing. Let me read for us. But the language here, the language in this psalm, is it's kind of familiar, right? And it's not familiar because you're psalm scholars and you've memorized the whole psalm, right? All the psalms. But the language is familiar. Let me read for us 11 to 21. Be not far from me, for trouble is near and there is none to help. Many bulls encompass me. Strong bulls of Bashan surround me. They open wide their mouths at me like a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. For dogs encompass me. A company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and feet. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. But you, O Lord, do not be far off. You, my help, come quickly to my aid. Deliver my soul from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dog. Save me from the mouth of the lion. You have rescued me from the horn of the wild oxen. There's familiar language here, right? The New Testament authors oftentimes quote the Old Testament, I think, for two reasons. First, because they were Jews who understood the Old Testament and knew its language, and they used it to make sense of who Jesus was as they experienced Him, as they walked with Him, as they listened to Him in the New Testament. They tried to make sense of who Jesus is, so they went back to the Old Testament to look to its promises and its fulfillments. And then they also, in order to try to communicate who Jesus is, they used the language of the Old Testament to bear witness to other Jews who knew the Old Testament that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. So there's a lot of familiar language here, right? My God, why have you forsaken me? That's what Jesus Himself says from the cross in Matthew 27:46 and also in Mark. Verse 7 and 8, all who see me mock me, they make mouths, they wag their heads at me. He trusts in the Lord, let Him deliver him. Let him who rescue him, for he delights in him. That's what Matthew, Mark, and Luke say that the scribes and the Pharisees, the chief priests, said about Jesus when He was on the cross. They were sarcastically blaspheming Him. And then even in verse 18, they divided my garments among them. And for my clothes they cast lots. That's what John says that the soldiers did about Jesus. And also Matthew and Luke speak to that. But there's even more than that. This whole section of 11 to 17 describes something that in 1000 BC, when David wrote this, no one knew about. Right? Crucifixion was a Roman invention. It wasn't a Jewish invention. The Jews didn't know anything about crucifixion. And yet, here's what one person writes about this. Psalm 22 is a graphic picture of death by crucifixion. The bones, the hands, arms, shoulders, and pelvis are out of joint, in verse 14. The profuse perspiration caused by intense suffering is in verse 14. The action of the heart is affected, verse 14. His strength exhausted and extreme thirst, verse 15. The hands and the feet are pierced, verse 16. Partial nudity with the hurt to modesty in verse 17 are all associated with the mode of crucifixion. The accompanying circumstances are precisely those fulfilled by the crucifixion of Christ. The desolate cry in verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? The periods of light and darkness of verse 2. The contemptuous and humiliating treatment of verses 6 to 8. The casting of lots in verse 18 were all literally fulfilled. When it's remembered that crucifixion was a Roman, not Jewish form of execution, the proof of inspiration is irresistible. Most commentators, especially even those commentators that are very reserved not to make leaps of jumps of faith or jumps of trying to stretch the data to say, oh, this proves Jesus. Even one of the best commentators on the Old Testament in the Psalms is Derek Kidner in the second quote, and he's very reserved about this kind of thing. This is what he writes in the second quote. No incidents recorded of David can begin to account for this, for the language of Psalm 22. Whatever the initial stimulus, the language of the psalm defies a naturalistic explanation. The best account is the terms used by Peter in a sermon concerning another psalm of David. Being therefore a prophet, he foresaw and spoke of the Christ. And so the psalmist here, David, is going through grief and lament. But he's writing about a situation 1,000 years beforehand that's it's much greater than he went through. He's prophesying, he's testifying in one sense of someone that would come and suffer extreme lament, extreme grief and sorrow. And so he's foreshadowing, he's prophesying that God cares about our lament so much that he personally enters into it. So think about it. We want out of our lament as quick as possible. We'll do almost anything to get out of our grief. Right? We'll sue. We'll rationalize. We'll cry out. We'll try anything to close that gap of our grief and lament. But Jesus actually willingly entered into grief. He chose to step and to enter into lament willingly, intentionally, out of love for us. It's first an avenue for us to understand and connect as we've come towards Good Friday to try to experience something of what Jesus went through in his trial and his lament. Because I think it's very hard for us to try to connect with what he went through in his passion and on the cross. Right? We can try to feel the words, the emotional words, but if we think about our lament, if we think about our times of sorrow, our gaps, and then we project that forward and we expand it, I think we might have a way to better connect with what Jesus went through in going to the cross on Good Friday. Because, you see, Jesus' lament was infinite. It was eternal. No one went through greater lament and sorrow than Jesus did. Now, that sounds like a kind of just a religious category statement. But if you think about it, there's lots and lots of reasons to lament things in our world, right? We can think about our personal loss and grief. We can think about women and girls being trafficked. That should not happen, but it is happening today. There's slavery. There's innocent victims of war. There's death. But Jesus' gap is he had, on one side, eternal relationship with the Father. He had a relationship of infinite love and honoring and respect and praise and joy together. But on the cross, God the Father turned his face away from Jesus. And so he lost all of that relationship. He lost all, that eternal relationship. He lost that infinite love that he had with the Father. Because when Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? God did forsake him. Because as Mike gave us the picture, all the sin, all of our rebellion and turning away and false salvation attempts were laid on Jesus. And the holiness of God had to look away and let Jesus bear all that by himself. So Jesus' gap was an infinite gap. Right? There's great lament and sorrow in our world today, but it is finite. Jesus' gap was infinite. There's sorrow and grief and mourning in this world, but it is temporary. There's a beginning and end in time to it. Jesus' gap was eternal. And so, how do you measure eternity? Right? How can you quantify eternity? How can you quantify the infinite? You can't. Jesus' lament was the greatest sorrow and grief and mourning that anyone ever experienced. And yet he chose to walk into that for us. So, Jesus' lament, him taking on that infinite grief and suffering, in some ways it closes down our gaps. He fills in our lament by himself because he takes away the eternality of death for us. Right? By him suffering eternally, he makes death not eternal for us. It's something we pass through, but we are able to pass through and have life with God again. We don't suffer eternal death as we would if Jesus didn't suffer eternally. And by Jesus suffering infinitely, he opens up the possibility that we will one day experience infinite love with God the Father. That we can experience touches of it now and pieces of it now, but by him suffering infinitely, we get to enter into the infinite love of God. If he didn't suffer infinitely, we wouldn't have that. And yet there is victory. Jesus suffered eternal, infinite lament. But God also brought about victory for him. It's interesting, if you look at verse 12, he describes his opponent. Many bulls encompassed me. They're surrounding him. There's no way out. Then verse 13, like ravening and roaring lions. The lion is the most fierce and deadly animal in Israel. So bulls, lions, and then dogs, verse 16. For dogs encompassed me. Dogs are not your pet here at all. It's not even Fido. These are scavenger dogs. These are packs of dogs that will go and eat anything, that whose hunger is never satisfied. They will go and eat rotting corpses or whatever they can find. And then the way that Hebrew and Greek oftentimes work is, the author's work is, they switch the order back again. So verse 20 is dog. Right? We had bull, lion, dog. We have dog in verse 20. And then verse 21, save me from the mouth of the lion. And then the wild oxen. The oxen is the strongest animal in the ancient world. And the wild oxen is the most powerful animal that exists. But the psalmist doesn't, but in verse 22 it turns. Verse 22, the psalmist doesn't end up on the horns of that wild oxen. He ends up in the house of God. I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. You, all the offspring of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him, all of the offspring of Israel. At verse 22, there's a turn. And other psalms have this similar thing. The psalmist is crying out, but then God does act. He does save, and the psalmist is able to turn to praise and out of comfort and out of satisfaction to give praise to God. And what's interesting is verse 22, I will tell your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I'll praise you. Is that familiar? That's what Hebrews 2:12 says that Jesus says. And Hebrews 2:12 says, puts that on Jesus' own lips in trying to explain how Jesus is greater than the angels. And so in some ways, Jesus has been saying that Hebrews just affirms what we see here. Jesus has been praying this whole psalm. He went through all of this grief, all of this lament. But God did raise him. God did rescue him in the end. After he went through eternal and infinite suffering, he raised him from the dead and granted him life again so that we might have life again. And so there's a path here for how we deal with grief, even how we prepare for grief by remembering God's promises. But there's also a path here to say, to begin to prepare for Good Friday and Easter, to realize in worshiping God well through this greatest event of Christ going to the cross and then rising again from the dead, that we realize he lamented for us. But his lament, fortunately, puts lament to death. Jesus in his death puts alienation and death to death. And ultimately, he's Jesus' death and resurrection takes the whole category of lament. It's going to take it out of the picture. Right? When we have life with God in heaven, there will be no lament. So it's only because Jesus entered into lament that he's able to take that whole category, bind it up, hold it, go through it himself, and cast it out the other side, that creation, that we would never experience it again. That's the fullness of our hope of the resurrection that we have through Jesus. Jesus, we praise you who created all things, who created all of us, all of humanity, was willing to step back into this world and go through the lament of being cast off from your Father in order to redeem us. It's not what should take place. The Creator should never be hung up on a cross. The one who gave us life should never be blasphemously maligned. And yet, you went through and endured that gap for us. Father, I pray that you would meet us, especially those of us that are mourning today, that you would meet us with comfort, that you would give us an extra measure of faith that we might come to you with the honesty of what we are experiencing, and that you would meet us and comfort us and walk with us through grief into a time of, in the future, rejoicing. For those of us, Lord, that are not lamenting now, but we can think back to times that we've experienced that gap of grief, would you help us to remember now how great are your promises and great are your actions to you've saved us in the past, that you've delivered to us so much more than we ever could deserve. Help us to remember those now that we might draw on them in the future. And Father, as we come towards the time to remember your Son's death for us, would you help us to think through his words here in Psalm 22, what he went through, that we might worship him in the process of remembering. We ask all this in Jesus' name.